Warning, the following episode contains elements that may be triggering to some audiences, including conversations about the mental, physical, and emotional abuse of adolescents, substance abuse, and suicide. Viewer discretion is advised. If you are experiencing a mental health emergency, call now. Help is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Call 855-CRISIS-1. That's 855-274-7471.
Welcome to this episode of Rooted Recovery Stories. My name is Patrick Custer, and I am your host. So very glad each and every one of you are joining with us. And for my very special guest today, Matt Jackman, National Mental Health Advocate and Lived Experience Specialist, Social Worker. The list goes on, and we're going to dive into that. But thank you so much for coming all the way from Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a whirlwind of a trip, and I'm just really grateful to have this opportunity to share a little bit about what I do and my story.
Yeah. I'm really, really, really excited to share our platform to elevate your story on our end of things. And it is a very unique one, and one that has just got more colors to it than I feel like are even in the rainbow. Mm. And so I wonder if you might give us a brief introduction into who you are and what you do today, what motivates you, and then we'll go back to the beginning.
Yeah, sure. I'm Matt Jackman. I identify as a non-binary queer person, with my pronouns being they, them. I'm someone that grew up in out-of-home care and foster care, and grew up in quite severe and significant material deprivation. Along with the disadvantages and oppressions, I've had a lot of privileges as well, being a white person, being somewhat middle class now and educated. I'm someone that lives with a mental health diagnosis of bipolar affective disorder and complex post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't use those terms. I don't use an illness framework to understand my experiences, and I can go into that. Mm-hmm. Both my siblings are voice hearers and live with schizophrenia. At the moment, I've kind of utilized my lived and living experiences from past and present in international activism. And a lot of the work I do now is around challenging the biological and medical model in mental health, and talking about a lot of the critical perspectives, the corruption, the monetizing of people's vulnerability and distress in mental health, rather than focusing on social justice perspectives and more the social, cultural, spiritual elements and political determinants of people's lived experience. I'm a consultant to the World Health Organization, and I'm currently writing an article for them on queerness and madness and the call to action for structural justice as a means to responding to an over-medicalization of queer folk and a need for a social justice approach to addressing our issues in our community. I also am the founder of my own organisation, TACFLE, the Australian Centre for Lived Experience, which is a mad pride collective. We can go into the term mad and what that means. It's an organisation that's open to people that have alternative ways of understanding their mental health experiences outside that diagnostic or medical or label lens. Mm. We do everything from education and research to helping to run mad pride activities and events. Such as, comedy shows or the arts. We also do a lot of work in international advocacy as well. I'm also an academic, so I teach within social work, and I'm a trained social worker as well as a trained peer specialist. And I did that training here in Los Angeles. And now I teach in MAD studies and research and lived experience research. So I'm sort of across freelance advocacy and activism, work for a number of international organizations in mental health activism, and being an academic, that also pays the bills as well.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Yep. Lovely. So you don't get into that. Most people, I would say, wouldn't get into that without having a bit of experience of their own. Yep. And we talked about having, coming from lived experience approach. So what was that for you?
Yeah. Well, it all starts back really intergenerationally.
Yes.
So, for a lot of people, doesn't it? It's such a, you can draw the lineage between, yeah, where these issues kind of manifested themselves. And for me, it was really, I mean, it probably started further back than my nan or my grandmother. But I think she didn't want to have children and felt very compelled to have children back in the kind of late 60s, early 70s, and kind of told my mum that she didn't want to have children. And had a very turbulent relationship with my mum. And a lot of her mental health issues weren't really talked about. She would send the kids away, you know, for school holidays to let, you know, Nan have a break. And then that kind of really embedded a lot of issues for my mum around attachment and grief and loss and trauma. And then my mum had a lot of issues herself and was bullied in school and I think was seen as very different, and part of that was the home environment that she was brought up in was very conservative, very religious, and I think she wasn't really able to have like a typical life. So yeah, she left the family home and kind of had a breakdown in her final year of school, and then met my dad, who was much older than her and already had five children. So there was a complex dynamic in that as well. And essentially her parents, my mum's parents, you know, weren't approving of my father. So that kind of extrapolated the mental health issues for her, because she was essentially abandoned by her parents. And my dad was from a different class and, you know, she was from more of a middle upper class. So there were a lot of those issues. And, you know, she sort of had a very severe postnatal depression after my brother and sister, and then had psychosis, and unfortunately took her own life when I was 9 years old and in foster care. And I was in foster care because she had, she had disclosed many times that she wanted to take her life with us, myself and my younger brother and sister.
Oh, wow.
And my dad wasn't a great father. So it was a lot of, alcohol issues at times, domestic and family violence, poverty, the stress of poverty as well.
Yeah.
We bounced around a bit.
As a child, do you remember the early messages? What were the early messages you remember thinking about your mom? You know what I mean? Like before you went into the foster system, you know, when she would say things like that, did you internalize that message? Were you scared? What went through your head?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've thought a bit more about this recently because trauma prunes your memory. Like that's part of the beauty and survival of trauma is that the body's smart. It protects itself. And a lot of my memories were suppressed for such a long time just because of what was going on. It was so confusing for me. I was very scared of my mum, particularly around, I've thought a bit more about this recently, but my experiences of her hearing things and talking to herself, particularly alone when she had divorced my father in the final few years of her life, was really confronting as like a 7-8 year old to kind of be witness to your mum, you know, struggling and crying and screaming and talking to herself. It's not something I've talked a lot about, but I do have some memories of just being really confused and scared, to the point where she kicked my father out one night, threw out all his clothes on the nature strip, and he drove to his friend's house. And I was so scared of her that I snuck in my dad's car, and he didn't find out I was there until he got to his friend's house where he was staying.
Wow.
So that memory always tells me that I obviously felt, even though my dad was a perpetrator of violence at that time, I actually felt more comfortable and safe with him, probably just due to the stability and safety, than I did my own mum. And that kind of breaks my heart a little because I know that she felt very guilty about not being able to attend to our needs. And there were other, I reread all my child protection case notes a few years back, and she wouldn't bring things like, you know, certain toys that I'd asked for to a family visit where we'd been removed, and I'd get really angry and not speak to her. So I think I have a lot of guilt around her being really unpredictable. And I think they're the messages. I don't remember anything that she said per se, but the memories are so deep that they're emotional. And they're a feeling. The memories are feeling. And that's, I think, where my complex trauma comes from. It's an emotional memory, you know, that kind of sense of what happened rather than a word or a sentence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the fact that you had all of those feelings and that premonition, and I mean, she was quite literally saying what she was going to do.
Yep.
And then she did it.
Mm.
Minus, you know, taking you and your siblings with you. When it happened, where did you go mentally and emotionally?
I think it was relief. I was relieved, which seems like a strange thing to say, but I think I was a very savvy 9-year-old. I was essentially a parentified child. I helped look after my brother and sister. I was very protective of them. And in some ways, I think, because I didn't feel very comfortable and safe around them. But I think I knew for a long time that she wanted to end her life. The last time I saw her was in a psychiatric hospital. Mm. And I could tell that she was saying goodbye. She gave me a birthday card. So she suicided in sort of early September. My birthday is July 31st. She gave me a birthday card, say in mid-August when I saw her in the hospital. Mm. And it was kind of like the kind of wording was essentially saying goodbye as this being the last birthday that we're going to have. And I think when I was told, I was in foster care, we were kept back from school, from elementary school, primary school. And I could sense something was off because our social worker would drive us to school for 1 hour each way, just because they was the only foster placement they could find for all three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And being held back from school was very rare. And they shut the doors and gave us some paper plates and feathers to play with. And I thought, this is very odd. Like, what are they doing? They shut the doors. They went and spoke to our foster carers. My next recollection is just, again, it's not a memory in terms of languaging, but a memory that's emotional. It was just, I just remember crying and then it's a blackout, you know? So I think at the time, I think it was relief because I knew how badly she wanted to die. And even her, like people that worked with her, like her family services or parenting support worker said, they were shocked that she lived for so long, you know, because she had such chronic suicidality,
right,
like daily for 6-7 years. And she'd been abandoned by her parents and had an abusive partner. She had no one. She literally had no one. Mm. She was left, and she was 28 at the time. So she never really got to have a life. Samantha never really got to have a life for her own. She went back to study, you know, but she had three kids. Like, how is she supposed to get by
right.
to do that?
Yeah.
So I think I was relieved for her and relieved for me that I didn't have to worry about this kind of to-ing and fro-ing between, you know, our parents and foster care and, yeah. So it's a strange thing to say, but I think that's how
that
I
was
made
your
sense
reality.
Of it.
And that, yep. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm.
That's not unboxing trauma again that you've, you know, is not easy. So I appreciate you bringing your vulnerability there. So in a step further vulnerability, like what, you know, just because all of that happens, it doesn't necessarily mean it gets better. Right. So moving forward, you know, what played out mentally and emotionally for you from that point forward?
Yeah, well, I think it's had a long-standing impact on my attachment, the way I relate to people. I mean, I struggle to trust people. My default is to not trust people, actually. People need to prove themselves. And I'm quite, at times, stoic and defensive and kind of suspicious of people and their intentions. I think people talk about trauma survivors being like good bullshit radars, you know, and you can suss someone out pretty easily, pretty quickly, because you've just gone through stuff yourself. But unfortunately, Dad had a few partners that were violent alcoholics. Dad had very little money and tend to find women whom, came from fairly middle upper class backgrounds, but had a lot of emotional stuff going on for them. And I think he was trying to find some material security for us and a family. But unfortunately, they were really and physically abusive as well. So, you know, as if we didn't need anything more.
Right.
We were in foster care for a year after Mum passed away due to allegations of him, sexually abusing my sister, because my mum's parents wanted... They blamed our father for her death, and they didn't want him to gain access of us. So they did anything and said anything so that he wouldn't gain access, even though they wouldn't look after us themselves. And they were young. They were like, my mum was 19 when she had me. So they were in their late 40s at this time. A year after that, Dad meets another partner, and she's extremely violent. To the point of, you know, like smothering me with a pillow, throwing our family photos to the ground, pushing my brother, me getting in, like trying to stop those sorts of fights. I suppressed a lot of this for a long time.
Yeah.
But as I've sort of healed or moved forward with, I don't know, I'm not sure I even believe in healing because the wounds are always there in some mm-hmm. regard. But just moving forward with life in recovery, I've started to remember and recollect more as I've just gotten older. Yeah. So that was unfortunate. And then I was dealing with my sexuality and kind of gender dysphoria as well. I didn't uncover that until a bit later, but I was a very anxious child because of what had gone on. I was always well-spoken and very savvy and a good leader. You know, I was kind of vice captain in both elementary and secondary school. I was house captain in high school, but I was always very popular, but never had close friends. Yeah. I think that's against that complex trauma thing where I'm like, I'm good with the performance. I'm good with the show. I'm good at bringing people together, but I find it difficult to relate on a really deep level to people just because I think there's something emotionally in me that just won't allow people in and maybe even allow myself in. So dealing with my sexuality is really hard. I went to a really low socioeconomic public school in secondary school. The one out person was bashed by their bisexual partner on the school oval. Wow. So that were the sorts of messages that I was told.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all relative, but 15 years ago, it was a different time.
Yeah.
It was here too. Yep.
Yeah. But I can only imagine, like, you already have messages of you're not safe at home, you're not safe at, you know, all.
Totally.
So then you've got these other differences.
Yeah.
Of course, you're going to question everything and seek safety, or even if it's not seeking safety, avoid things that might
totally
bring more unsafety.
Yeah. And avoidance became a really core part of who I was for a long time, almost as my substance. Mm-hmm. But it was an actual physical avoidance of things. It was, not attending things or staying home from school. When I was probably both 11 and 14, I was at school about 20% of the year.
Wow.
I used to hide under my bed and listen to the radio, a sports radio station, because I wanted to be a sports journalist. How far we've come.
Right.
But to me, I was clearly processing what was going on, the grief, the trauma. To me, I was just anxious. I thought it was about my sexuality, and I was just avoiding the world. But I think I was just so confused by what had gone on, what had happened to me, that I literally retreated into my own world. The school counselor would come to my door to pick me up to take me to school. That's how bad it got.
Wow.
I'd fallen so far behind. And fortunately, from 14 to 15, they really pushed me into school leadership activities and kind of almost forced me to like be actively involved in the school. Those messages told me that I wasn't safe anywhere. And I think that's just where I learned to just trust myself and not trust those around me, the world around me, which still impacts me today in some regard in terms of intimacy and relationships. It was really challenging. My dad said that homosexuality was a disease when I was 15. So again, these messages, him also being a perpetrator of violence, but me also reconciling the relationship and him looking after us, all these complex relationships that are both like, you're a savior, but you're also our abuser. It was just really hard for me to make sense of what a healthy relationship even looked like, you know?
Yeah. So, I think, you know, I always ask this question, you know, what made you move forward and decide to pursue and make it through school? I think about myself, right? I've shared with you some of my past struggles and what have you. I can't imagine having the lived experience that you do from those ages and being able to adjust to life and can pursue a college and, you know, or university, you know, do the things that you've done. Where did you draw your tenacity, drive, passion from, and kind of what is the story there?
Yeah, well, I think there's something in lived experience being a superpower when you kind of unlock the potential. Maybe it's the overcoming. Maybe it's the post-traumatic growth. I mean, there's also a meaning, a spirituality around recovery too, and in finding oneself and overcoming. They're at least the stories that I tell myself, and I do believe that my experiences have made me who I am, and that in some ways trauma has socially engineered me into leadership. Because I had to lead to protect my siblings. Mm. I had to lead to protect myself. I was put in positions where it was survival. It was make or break. It was either die or live, yeah. You know, at times. So, in many ways, that just, I think, pushed me into leadership capacity and a self-belief, I think, as well, in wanting something better. I think my mum's family as well came from a different class, and I think I always had that in the background, that life could look different, it could look better. There was hope, you know, like it's hope. And I always, even though I went to a really poor school where not many of us went to college, university, maybe 30-40%, I always wanted to go. I wanted a better life. Yeah. And I got in. I had another breakdown in my final year of school, just like my mum, you know, kind of these synchronous cycles.
Yeah.
I didn't do well in my final exams. And I got one of the lowest scores to get into university, but I got in. And I did like a food science degree. But I was so debilitated with anxiety due to my own mental health struggles. That I found it hard to make friends. I was still in the closet. I was still avoiding depth and relationships with people. So, when it got to the time of college, I would try to avoid parties and just avoid situations where I'd have to talk about like intimacy or love or sex or anything that involved any depth, any real depth. And I was so ashamed of my upbringing. I didn't talk about any of this up until I really started moving into social work and in my career, my employment career. So a lot of my journey has been about finding pride in things that have shamed me and things that have kept me, you know, avoiding and things that have helped me to engage and connect with my experience and with my journey, but also with other people. That's been such an important theme and narrative in my life. I flunked a few subjects. I failed three subjects and got a high distinction in the fourth. I did a Matt Jackman, as I like to say. and the final subject that I got the high distinction, this is after I came out where I was very suicidal and had my first attempt at taking my life. It was a behavioral subject, a psychology subject. So I went and saw the school counselor and said, look, I don't want to do this food science degree. I'm not good with biology and maths and chemistry. And I said, you know, I've thought about counseling. I'm good with people. I'm good socially, like I'm very socially aware and quite political, you know, I guess given my experiences. And she said, oh, have you thought about social work? And I was at a university. It was quite political as well. And the rest is history from there. I did a few social work subjects, sociology, and I just loved it. I loved it. And I think it was just because I understood from a lived experience perspective what all this theory meant. You know, I understood privilege. I understood oppression. I understood social injustice. I understood power and how power operates in relationship and in society, whether it was through, you know, my mum and dad's experiences of gender-based violence or whether it was through my own experiences of homophobia and genderphobia. I had a really deep sense of what that meant, which means I just got it. You know, it wasn't like I had to learn new things. And then that really kind of led me into the mental health space and having a focus on that. I continued to do lots of leadership stuff at uni, and ran our social work club. And then worked in forensic mental health and, slowly weaved in and out of international mental health due to my own experiences of my mood fluctuating through mania and depression. Had a few manic binges internationally and attended a few conferences and got a name for myself in being quite articulate.
I thought you were going to say I got a name for myself for acting out.
Oh, well, probably that too. Yeah, probably that too.
Oh my gosh. No, sorry. Sometimes I have a knack for being irreverently inappropriate. And so...
So do I.
I make a name for myself in that regard. Yep. But no. So, which, I mean, is really cool. As I was reading up on you and some of the things that you've done, I mean, I'm just like, wow, this person has done some really neat things and represented such important causes at such on such a worldwide scale. Awesome. I mean, you're the first person I think I've ever talked to that has represented the mental health side of things at such a high level. And that's really cool.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's really cool for me, you know? I'm kind of curious, what has been your takeaway from being in those spaces that you didn't, was there something that you've taken away from being in those spaces that you didn't already know? Or do you feel like it was more you were bringing information to them?
Yeah, I think it's like any, I guess, relationship. There's a reciprocity, or you would hope, in a healthy relationship of giving and taking. And I think being involved with organizations like, CBM International and the Global Mental Health Peer Network, World Health Organization. I've been really lucky to be sent places by Harvard Global Mental Health. Like, I've had a lot of privileges in the work that I've gotten to do. And it's come from a lot of hard work as well. Like, I think I've worked very hard. I've spent a lot of my travel money as well doing work, essentially. I don't really have vacations. Matthew doesn't have vacations. I kind of have working holidays.
Okay.
But to me, it's not work. Like, I'm doing what I love.
Yeah.
And I'm living my mum's spirit now. That's why I came out as non-binary, to kind of honor that I'm a two-spirited person, and that I'm kind of doing legacy work with her, not for her, but with her. And like, this is Samantha's voice speaking, you know, we're kind of speaking together on this journey, and I'm getting to honor like the voice that she never got to have, and the lost life and lives that we lose to addiction, mental health. You know, that to me is, it's just really empowering. It's a very deeply personal and spiritual experience. But the key learnings for me are that really, you know, firstly, mental health is extremely corrupt. And there's a manufacturing of victims. There's a mental health economy. There's an economy that makes a lot of money off people that suffer or experience vulnerability, or just neurodiversity, where people aren't understood for their experiences of neurodiversity, or society just can't support people with experiences that they aren't trained or educated to deal with. So that's a big takeaway for me. And that we see that through Big Pharma and the over-medicalization of people's human experiences. And things like hospitals and, you know, professional associations. And there's a lot of vested interests and stakeholders because it makes money. So that's a big takeaway. I think in terms of like, the giving and the taking, I mean, this is such a personal journey that I think it's helped me to have a voice. Someone said to me the other day that a lot of comedians, they get into comedy because often they didn't have a voice growing up.
Right.
And I can really relate to that. Yeah. I think that I've always been like a Leo, a bit of a loudmouth, not always, but I think I found my voice and found my personality. I was involved in a lot of theater growing up until my mum died. I think my mum always kind of knew I was an artsy kid. Yeah. And then dad, you know, with the abusive relationships, that was all cut. I didn't get involved in anything. I was kind of not a favorite child. My brother was the sporty one, and I was just kind of left to my own devices. Mm. So I think for me, the journey of international activism is so immensely powerful for me in my recovery. It's made me believe that I have a purpose. Mm-hmm. It's made me believe that I want to live. I didn't want to live. I wanted to kill myself for 15 years. So it's pretty powerful to be in a place where I don't have those thoughts. Every now and then I do, they come back. It's kind of like your gas tank, you know, sometimes when you're really depleted and you're low, the engine light, or the, you know, the petrol light, the gauge starts flickering. And that's what happens for me when I'm in a low place. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I have a reason to live now. And doing the work that I do has given me that. The platform that I have has given me that. And I just literally do what I love every day. Like, this is so enjoyable. It's so enjoyable to have 18-year-olds that are from Turkey or Georgia messaging you saying, I love what you do. We don't have that in this country. You really inspire me. I mean, what more could you want out of life?
Right.
Like, connection, purpose, meaning, what more is there?
You know? That is the ultimate.
It truly. And then to get paid, not for everything. And I've done a lot of volunteering. A lot of this is volunteering. But to get paid to do to be an activist, to get paid to be a teacher, an educator, a mentor, a coach, I mean, I just, yeah, there's something in me, I think, never having had much connection growing up, either to myself or others, or community for that matter, I never felt like I belonged to anything. And I think my whole life is about bringing people together for that reason. And I think a lot of people kind of speak to that.
Absolutely. You know? That definitely resonates.
Yep. Yeah.
Internally for me as well.
Totally. Totally.
Gosh, you are such an eloquent speaker. Like, so well spoken. And I just feel like it's very captivating with what you share. And I mean, you could probably tell me just about anything and I'd believe it.
Kath and Kim.
All right, listen. And if you're listening or watching, insert a comedic moment here. Matt and I were joking. Actually, I was being quite serious about how much I love this show from Australia called Kath and Kim. If you have not watched it or if you've not heard of it, I'm just saying it has significantly improved the quality of my life over the past year. Mm. It is one of the funniest comedies I've ever seen. You can catch it on Netflix right now, as of now anyway. Oh my gosh. I don't know. Do you have a favorite Kath and Kim episode or moment or line?
I think it's just like, Kimmy, look at me, look at me. that's definitely the one-liner I think that everyone loves to repeat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But comedy, humor, isn't that an important part of recovery?
Like, yes.
Getting to have a laugh. The world can be so intense that for me, I don't know if that resonates with you, but just... yeah, getting to like live life in a lighter way and just releasing your body has been so therapeutic for me. I think because of all my trauma, like I'm just a naturally funny person. I've had to make light of some fucking darkness.
Yeah.
You know what
absolutely.
I mean? Like if you don't, what's the term? Like if you don't laugh, you cry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I love that you just went right there because I'd like to point out something that I think is an important distinction. I think many comedians use comedy to cover up and not feel. You just use the terminology. It's an outlet to release. And those are two very different things.
Totally.
And I've always wondered about that. I've interviewed a few comedians on this show thus far, but none of them have necessarily been like had the history of, when I think about, some of the comedians that have lost their life to suicide don't necessarily have that dark past. And so I'm glad we're talking about that today. And I mean, I'm literally processing this in real time. And so I'm just so grateful for the terminology you just used because that's enlightening to me. And I'm sure hopefully it's, you know, somebody, because I think there are two very distinct differences there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not to say that I'm perfect and do it well all the time. Like I also have used comedy as a means to block and to avoid as a coping mechanism, as a tool for recovery in an unhealthy way. I think it's about finding the balance and understanding the intention of where you're going with that humor.
Yeah.
Just being self-aware and like, what's the purpose of this right now? Even like dating, you know, I've kept people away by being funny and not being my real self. So there's definitely times where it hasn't always been perfect for me. But I'm learning to find the light in it and just owning it, like owning being the eccentric person that I am. Like I'm like wacky.
I love that.
And I think that we all need to be a little just ourselves, you know, try and get out of the socialized roles that we are. And I think humor is just a big part of that. Yeah.
Absolutely. You used a term that as an American, I've heard this growing up, but it's been years since I heard somebody refer to somebody as mad. So I wanted to ask you to dive into that definition.
Yep.
And kind of some more behind what your platform is, right? Because it's probably some would say a little bit different than your typical mental health advocate.
Totally. Yep, totally. So,
yeah, if you would share more about that, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, well, this one little word, it does really represent a lot in my life. Yeah. And like, I identify with being queer and, you know, non-binary. I also identify as a mad person. I don't identify necessarily as a psychiatric survivor, or I certainly don't identify as a person with a mental illness. You know, I've had responses to trauma. That's very different to having a mental illness. So mad is a way to essentially subvert that diagnostic medical language, you know, of you have a disorder, you're a problem, you're a disease, you're an illness. Mad kind of throws that language back in kind of the medical model's face, and really reclaims that terminology, because mad's been used historically as a pejorative term to describe people, you know, similarly, like, you know, they're psycho, you're crazy. These are all sanist. It's all sanist language. It's mental and emotional ableism. And it's thrown around all the time. I hear it all the time. Mad is another one of those historical words that's been used to denigrate us and to other us in society. And a lot of psychiatry in the medical model is about power and control and kind of managing deviants of society, people that don't understand, you know, put them away, put them in a home, lock them up, you know, lock their minds up with medication, you know, eliminate their cognitive liberty. There's there's a lot of darkness in this space. So similarly, like, the queer community reclaimed the term queer. Us folk in the mental health community, some of us, not all of us, have reclaimed the term mad as a means to subvert that medical discourse that seeks to blame the individual for the experiences they've had, for the traumas that they've had. Trauma is often located in relationships, in family, in community. I mean, you know, homophobia or genderphobia, you know, racism, sexism. So there's a real politicalness to our experiences. The medical model seeks to blame the individual and says, well, you have depression, you have anxiety, you have bipolar. So it's your responsibility to take your pills, do your therapy. It blames the individual for the injustices of society. So for me, saying that I'm mad is taking a political stance. It's taking an advocacy stance. And it's also taking a liberatory stance. Like, it's empowering to say I'm mad. Because again, that is used in a way that has been used to other, my community in the past. Just like I use the term queer, I find it very liberating. I'm proud of that. It's just who I am. And using the term mad is sort of the faction of our community. Similarly, again, with the queer community, you've got the LGBTIQ plus A community. We have our own variations within the mental health community. You know, there's people that identify as psychiatric survivors, and they're people that have often been really violated quite badly by the system, or, you know, they've had electroconvulsive therapy and they've had memory deficits. There's people in the neurodiverse faction. There's people in the consumer service user space. And then there's the mad pride people, which are all about, well, I'm actually proud of my madness. I don't need to be controlled. I don't need to be managed. And I certainly don't need to be told that what's happened in my life is my fault. My brain's not broken. I've just responded to a broken world. You know, like, that's, you know, I'm not to blame for the injustices of society, you know, and that's what the medical model seeks to do, because there's money in medicine, there's money in big pharma, and there's money in assessment and diagnosis and therapy. So they're all the vested stakeholders, you know.
So I have to ask a quote unquote devil's advocate question here.
Go for it.
So to the person, or, you know, the opposite end that's right, arguing one way.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Because obviously you get to a certain place and you have these instances where, whether it's suicidality or the roller coaster of the bipolars and what have you. And I don't know what your experience is with the bipolar, but but many times there are behaviors associated that come with consequences, right? Totally. That are detrimental to our life.
Yep.
And so living with that. Mm. What, from your perspective, to live life authentically and to its fullest and the most, to respect yourself the most, how do you view the right way to go about, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because
at some point, like, I hear you when you say, you know, it's a broken system, and I honestly agree. I agree, but also because I know I deal with my own stuff that a lot of the things that I struggle with that are, I think, lifelong things that will never go away. I have to have coping skills, right? So where does that come into play, right? Because it's not, I can't imagine that you're saying there's nothing, like, there's nothing, I just accept it all and hunky-dory for the rest and the, you know, let the cards fall as they may. So in that realm of things, what do you view or believe about caretaking for your own mental health?
Well, mad pride is certainly not to dismiss that some people do have a biological understanding and do believe that they have an illness or a disease or a disorder. Like, it's just about offering a different and alternative explanation, a different discourse, a different languaging, and a more empowering one as well, that doesn't seek to blame the individual for everything that they've experienced. But it's not to say that we don't have organic issues, that the brain is not neurobiological. Like, of course. We also don't have a lot of science, though, to support a lot of these, you know, myths around, you know, kind of a broken brain and a lot of the treatment responses through medication. But I'm a big believer in having the option, the choice. So the MAD movement's all about advocating for empowerment. So that's through choice and control. So if people do need to take medication, and some people do, I take medication when I need it. Mm-hmm. So I harm reduction myself. Sometimes I don't listen to my psychiatrist. In fact, they talk more about their problems than they do about mine. So yeah, I only visit him really because he's got a lovely forest in his office. but yeah, you know, in all honesty, like, I when you know yourself really well, you're able to take those, you know, those choices as tools for recovery. So if I'm entering an elevated state with my bipolar or manic depression, I will take Seroquel to help me with sleeping and to get me to bed. Similarly, I've trialed antidepressants before. I haven't found them useful. Other medications for my anxiety. But I don't take them consistently. I take them as needed, like any other health issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like we always take everything that's lifelong. But the medical model says that we have these lifelong issues that always need to be treated with a medical response. So I'm just very nuanced in my coping strategies. I'm a big believer in personal medicine, like personal coping. And sometimes that's like through music. That's through friendship and connection. That's through dancing and singing and being mad, like being yourself.
Yeah.
You know, not feeling, oppressed or judged by society, getting to do your own thing. It's through things like travel. It's through things like writing. There's, you know, everyone has their strategies in their own way, whether healthy or unhealthy in the long term or short term. We all have ways of coping and dealing with things. So for me, a mad pride perspective is just to say, I am me, all of me. I'm not just a broken person. And that there are also, I have a mad worldview. There are mad ways and mad coping ways of supporting me and of me supporting myself. And that just means that there's more than just medication and therapy.
Yeah.
You know, and there's other cultural and spiritual practices as well, and political practices. So a mad perspective in my recovery is taking an activist stance. That's empowering. That's helping me in my journey to avoid lapsing into suicide, depression, mania. If I'm feeling more in control of myself, if I'm feeling more in control of my world and my sense of safety, that's a trauma-informed response. Being an advocate is like a trauma-informed intervention.
Absolutely.
I don't need therapy for that. Like, I need to feel like I can reclaim back the power that's been violated in my life.
Sure.
So that's what I mean by like a mad perspective. It's just that there's more than just a psychological or biological approach to an individual approach to supporting someone. Yeah. Hmm. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yep.
And I love what you talked about is bringing back choice for the individual that feels like the system or their families have been, because I know a lot of the time, I don't know how your mental health care system is different from ours here in the United States. I mean, I know some years back things changed, and you can't just, you know, you couldn't as a misogynistic husband be like, my wife is crazy and get her committed anymore, you know, like, but that was a thing in decade, like the, in my parents' lifetime.
Totally.
And, I mean, it is a lot more difficult to get someone committed, and it's only a short period of time that that can happen here in the United States.
Yep. Yep.
And it's only for if their life is, if they're an immediate threat to themselves or others. From what you understand about our mental health care system here versus what it's like in Australia, is it similar, or is there, are there less liberties for the individual there than there are here?
Yeah, it's similar and different. We have a two-tiered system, a public and a private system. So the private system is people voluntarily admitting themselves, where you don't have a deprivation often of choice and control. You have the right to leave if you voluntarily admitted yourself, although sometimes you can be made involuntary if you, you go involuntarily. Our public system is more similar to the American system, where you can be involuntarily detained and have those liberties removed, have those choices and those controls removed, and it's a very disempowering experience. And people that are often in distress talk about a lot of the trauma, which we call like iatrogenic. It just means trauma of the system. So it's not trauma of people, but it's trauma actually of accessing the service. It's like therapy. Sometimes therapy can be really harmful if you've got someone that doesn't know what they're doing,
right,
and they're telling you things and invalidating your experiences, just because it's a service doesn't mean it's helpful to you. You know what I mean? So, yeah, we talk a lot about the service system being, you know, harmful when it, particularly when it's restrictive and involuntary. And you can certainly be in hospital for longer after that 72-hour hold. And a lot of people are detained. But a lot of people are now incarcerated in the prison system. So we're seeing this move from the asylum era of the last 40, 50 years. And we're seeing a, what we call a reinstitutionalization in the prison system, where a lot of people in the prison system have really significant mental health issues and have been completely abandoned and left because of the inadequacies in the mental health system. And again, these systems are for profit. You know, the carceral systems in America are profit driven.
Absolutely. You know, I, the parallel that I could say that I see that personally is that, and there's been a lot of movement in positive directions, but you know, I shared with you earlier that I'm in addiction recovery, and we see in our now this isn't everywhere in the United States, but in many of larger cities we've got what they call drug court. So if you're a first offender, or I mean, it's not, drug court isn't always offered to everyone if you've got a million offenses, right? But if in some way, shape, or form, you're in before a judge, and it's clearly substance. You're making poor choices, poor life choices in society that you know have brought about these consequences that are related to, you know, the influence of drugs and alcohol. Drug court is an option because, and it's an alternative to jail, and actually caters to the rehabilitation. You know, both mentally and physically, you know, rather than institutionalizing somebody in a something that's not going to help them get acclimated to society and get better. And I've known a lot of people who, as a sober person now in recovery rooms that I've met, had the privilege of getting to know and meet that got sober that way, and they're living beautiful lives now. But as you were saying that, I was thinking at the same time going, whoa, yeah, we've got so many people that don't even have, it's not a substance use issue. Our prison systems are overrun here, and they're, it's weird how they're set up, because they're like very, I think most of them are private. But subsidized, but I don't really... It's weird. It's very odd. And it's a huge moneymaker. And very corrupt. I think that you would find, you'd be hard pressed to find people that would argue otherwise here.
Yeah.
Other than people that are benefiting from it.
Yeah. Well, it's the same with the private psychiatric system. You know, like we have a saying back home where in the private system, they can't wait to keep you for as long as they can because they're getting $1,200 insurance a night. Mm. In the public system, they can't wait to get rid of you because there's so little funding in the public system that you are in and out. You know, so it's even hard to sometimes get, in your words, you know, admitted to a hospital.
Yeah.
So it's like there's this real disjoint even back home in that. And yeah. And as an alternative, like you're talking about recovery rooms, like our alternatives for like drug court in the mental health space, recovery space, are like lived experience run services. So like a peer respite. Yes. I don't know if you've heard of a peer respite. I think it exists a bit more in the drug and alcohol space, actually, like mm-hmm. peer run, you know, self-help stuff.
Yes.
But that's what we want. We don't want to be driven by the medical mm-hmm. model, which is really just seeking to monetize our experiences.
Well, so I was doing some research to educate myself further this year mm-hmm. in preparation for National Mental Health. We celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month in mm-hmm. May. I don't know if that's yep. when everybody else does, but we first celebrated, recognized that in, oh God, it was either 1959 mm-hmm. or 1961, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know what brought about that specific time. Yep. You know, it was coming off the heels of a lot of trauma from war and mm-hmm. different things. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the institution, like the institutions that we talked about, mm. and the coming out of that mm. was brought about by people like Judy Chamberlain,
yes,
and yep. Yep. some of the other people, such as yourself, that were you're talking about, like advocated and they were mm. activists because mm. of their lived experience being through the system,
totally.
And all they were asking for and saying is, we want to be treated like human beings, yep. And we feel like we can get mm. better and mm. live healthier, happier, mm. all these things through mm. community, peer support, totally. Rather than yep. people who are reading a book and, yep. and you know, wagging their finger at us mm. and then mm. giving us a mm. shot and
yep. yeah,
numbing us out. Mm. And so I think for the reason why I bring it up, I'm mm. like, I know you know this information, but mm. for anybody that doesn't mm. know, in the United mm. States, mm. that was what people like Judy and people yeah. doing what you're doing are the reason why we were able to get out of this place of having institutions where people were locked up for the rest of their life and never yeah. saw yeah. another. And just for the, mm. because they were deemed mad.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. Yeah. Yeah.
And
now we see, you know, often the issue is just displaced because of funding, you know. Mm-hmm. So instead of people being in an asylum or in an institution, they're in prison. Or instead of a prison, they're homeless. Or instead of being homeless, they're in an addiction center. Like people are almost just displaced, you know, mm-hmm. in different areas that would have traditionally been in an asylum 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's just, we see there was not the, when we had the deinstitutionalized movement, there wasn't, the funding that was promised was not allocated into community. So a lot of the discourse around that was about, you know, human rights, like people shouldn't be locked up for the rest of their lives. Mm. But I think there was a human rights issue, but a lot of it was actually about government saving money so they didn't have to pay for these expensive asylums.
No way.
I believe there's definitely
was sarcasm in my voice.
Yeah, there's like a whole, it's like, yeah, like where was
you mean they weren't being altruistic in that endeavor?
Yeah, it's sort of like, well, where was the money for families to support people to go home? Where was the money in housing for these people? Like, and yeah. my mum was a victim and survivor of that because it was the mid-90s when she had, like, deinstitutionalization was really up to the early mid-90s, and she was in that weird kind of era where there wasn't wow. really a lot of community mental health systems and support because everyone had just been ousted. So that's why we need, yeah, we call in the MAD movement, or we call in the consumer lived experience survivor, psychiatric survivor movement for, yeah, community, for connection, for alternatives, peer alternatives. But a lot of these don't require as much money.
Yeah.
And there's not an economy around social justice.
Right.
Because often it is preventative, and it's about eliminating a lot of and dismantling a lot of these systems of white supremacy and patriarchy, capitalism. capitalism, for the betterment of humanity, for the quality of life of humanity on the ground. So we're up against it. There's a lot of structural political determinants that really, you know, weigh against us in the mental health space. Again, just due to the power and the dynamics of the service system. Yeah. Mm. And I wanted to mention just quickly on the note of like women being, admitted or committed due to hysteria. A lot of men would do that, you know, if they were in infidelity relationships.
Right.
And it was a means to, it was totally a patriarchal means to get rid of their partners. I mean, we've seen psychiatry in the medical model seek to medicalize and other almost every oppressed community, from black slaves running away from slave camp. There was a diagnosis called drapetonia. homosexuality, of course, gender right. identity disorder, hysteria for women. Like, if you really look back at history, there's a very clear link between the medicalization, the psychiatrization of people that are oppressed, which says to you that psychiatry is actually used as a tool for social control by those that are in the dominant norm. So it's very dark when you really think about it. Psychiatry is in a very dark space and having a bit of an identity crisis at the moment, because a lot of the neurobiological literature, a lot of the biological literature is actually being debunked at the moment. Mm. So it's like, well, if psychiatry doesn't have a strong biological focus and emphasis in mental health, then what is its place in mental health if people's issues are more environmental, you know, whether mm-hmm. it's trauma or stress or relationships or whatever. It's just an important note to mention, I think, for the viewers, because, there's a history of oppression being psychiatrized, being medicalized, blaming the individual, you know what I mean? Social injustice.
Mm. I am so glad that you drew that lineage for us, because I did not know that about the slaves. Mm. I mean, of course, know that about homophobia and the hysteria of women. But when you put it all together like that, it just like draws a line that makes you go, wow. So, before we get, I've got a couple last questions for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious on where your perspective is on, obviously being somebody, a consumer of medication when you need it.
Yep.
Obviously comes from psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to exist to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you propose from a MAD perspective, right? Like, how do those work together in a way that is respectful, right? What in a world where you see ultimate peace and autonomy, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's multiple answers. There's a plurality of truths to this question for different people. But for me, like a MAD perspective, a MAD world, and a MAD response to supporting MAD folk, I think starts with understanding that there's a hierarchy of knowledge in society. And you only need to know that to know that, like, you know, doctors and lawyers have a lot of privilege and status and power in society. And you see that in mental health, where psychiatry has the power. And then at the bottom is lived experience. That's the least valued, you know, or recovery is often the least valued discipline of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is just pay attention to that and kind of deconstruct the very notion of the sorts of power that we pay attention to knowledge in mental health, and just value things more equitably, like value different knowledges in more equitable ways. So maybe it's not the doctor and the psychiatrist that make the decision making around the person. Maybe it's still led by the person or led by the family in support. So it harps back to having choice and control and empowerment. It comes back to power. So it's not okay and not appropriate to have your rights violated. You need to be as informed as possible. You need to have the opportunity to say no. You need to have, the opportunity to have an advocate. You need the opportunity to harm reduction yourself if you choose to do that, and have the education and literacy. None of us get that. Psychiatrists don't tell you how to harm reduction off psych meds.
Right.
They kill people 20 years younger. Like, these are facts. Like, psych meds, particularly antipsychotics, psychotics. People that live with people that live on taking antipsychotics die 20 years younger.
Wow.
Like, it's pretty serious. Yet we're told that we have these diagnoses and these diseases and disorders where we need medication for life. People that have come out of that, I mean, I just met all these people at Mad Camp, a lot of people that aren't taking medication anymore, but were told by psychiatrists that they would have this for life and would need to take these pills for life. It's just blatant disregard. It's completely unethical. Mm. So for me, it's just having options. Yeah. It's to say that, yes, we don't actually have all the answers, but yes, we do need to take medication at times to help manage whatever's going on inside of us. Just be more, have more humility and humbleness in the approach, mm-hmm. rather than like viewing psychiatry as this sort of, as this godlike figure. Yeah, as the ultimate figure. And acknowledging like the trauma underlying a lot of our experiences. Like, maybe the responses need to be in like a particular therapy or a somatic experience. Or maybe we just need like a community and family that's mm-hmm. not like distressed and constantly triggering. Like, there's so many other responses. But again, the system is driven by the market and economy around medication. Mm-hmm. So all the power is paid attention to in psychiatry because of that, because of this sort of capitalistic driver.
Right.
Rather than actually, well, what's the genesis? Like, what's the underlying cause of the person's experience? Is mm-hmm. it more organic? Like dementia or, there right. are organic issues of the brain. But for most people, like 80, 90% in the literature of service users in public mental health have a history of trauma.
So no.
what does that say?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what is that telling you? That yep. these diagnoses, these diseases, they're not a disease. They're the body and the mind and the soul's way to cope.
That's right.
They're a response. Mm-hmm. They're a survivalistic response, whether it's dissociation and detachment through psychosis. For me, all of that trauma I grew up with, like, of course my mood fluctuates.
Yeah.
I'm in a constant state of hypervigilance.
Yep.
I'm not diseased, you know what I mean? But mm-hmm. that's the discourse, that's the language that I've been sold. So the MAD perspective is just offering. It's about offering alternatives and paying attention to the power of the different disciplines, whether it's a more cultural perspective, a more spiritual perspective. A lot of us in the MAD movement have a spiritual perspective to our experiences, and people talk about psychosis being like a spiritual crisis.
Mm.
Or suicide being a spiritual crisis or an existential crisis, right. of like, why am I here? Why am I living?
Mm-hmm.
Again, not a disease, not an illness for some people. It's just about having choice, control, peer alternatives, options, and an acknowledgement that medication is okay as long as you have the rights and the choices to manage that, control that, and have the information to and harm reduce yourself.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
100%.
Yeah. So it's not anti-psychiatry.
You do such a great job of explaining all of this, by the way. So I mean, this has been really enlightening for me, and just like I'm going to repeat myself, but you've turned the lights on for me in a way that I, am seeing things from a different perspective than I've been able to see them before. So for that, I'm so grateful.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A lot of moving parts in this space. Yeah. A lot of moving parts.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hope this has been provoking for those of you who are listening or watching today. Because it has been for me too, especially because I come from the mental health field where, but I'm also, so me and I think so many people who work in this field want to find new ways. Mm-hmm. I don't think, we've got to evolve.
Yeah.
We've got to evolve.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I would love to see, I mean, I hate to say this, but like, I would love to see in an idealistic world, I'd love to see us out of business and that you know what I mean? And that there wouldn't be a need for it, but that's never going to, never going to happen. There's going to be some bit of need, but I love that you talked about autonomy and choice.
Yep.
And that's the big thing that I took away from this is that like the dignity, autonomy and choice is something that everybody has the right to.
Totally.
And, I just love that. So for that person or those people that have just like you've really spoken to today, and they've identified, and I just want to ask, I always love to ask this last question. Yeah. What would be your like leaving word of encouragement for them? They're like, this is making sense for me. And I felt like I am part of stuck in that cycle or that problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
How can they pursue making a change via the avenues that you have?
Yeah. Well, on a personal level, I'd say find your people, find your tribe, find those that are going to support, acknowledge, validate you, help you to build trust and safety to support you in your own decisions around your journey, your recovery. I'd say get connected to the broader MAD movement, the consumer, survivor, ex-patient, neurodiverse movement, because in that space, you'll have alternatives to understanding your experiences from social, cultural, spiritual, structural, political understanding. So it will move away from just being sold the psychological and medical discourse and understanding of your experience. So, you know, MAD studies is a great field to dip into and read about. And yeah, getting involved in the MAD Pride space, I think, is another wonderful way of connecting with alternative explanations to our experience and understanding as well the social justice and politics of our experience too. Yeah. That you're not a walking deficit, you're not a walking problem, you're not a disease, you're not in illness, you're not a disorder, you are responses to the world. And at least having a more balanced perspective in that, I think is probably my parting words. And find people that believe in you and do your best to build relationships, because at the end of the day, I think life is all about, we were saying before, hope, connection, meaning, recovery. It's about recovery, you know, and that's deeply spiritual, deeply philosophical and existential. So yeah,
absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
Matt
me.
Jackman. This has been so wonderful. And with that, I will close out how I always do and remind each and every one of you that it is never too late to start loving yourself, and you're only ever one decision away from a completely different life.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one are struggling with trauma, addiction, or mental health, we are ready to answer your questions and help you take that next step. Call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promises.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.